I'm Nicolien Berger.
And I'm Jana Vosloo.
And this is Air It.
Okay.
Hello, Nicolien.
Hello, Jana. We are in my Grot studio today in Fishhoek. And there will potentially be some domestic noises and dogs, but we don't know what's going to happen, and we're not cutting it out, so let's
see. You know the drill by now. I took a nice morning drive, and we went to the beach, had a snack and a coffee, and yeah, we decided we are together, so why not record? But we both have very little. We don't know what we want to say yet.
No, we have maybe a theme, and we're going to see where it goes. So Jana told me that she had an interesting conversation with her brother last night about work and productivity, which I obviously have a lot to say about, but I don't know anything about the conversation. So why this theme, Jana, and what did you say to each other so I can also know?
I mean, it wasn't like a crazy, profound conversation necessarily, but it just talking about it made me realize that it's one of those topics that I'd love to air out with you.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about, so my brother is currently in South Korea, and in a way I think him and I have a very similar phone ritual than Nicolien and I used to have. Which was the birth of Air It. So my brother and I also practice Air It conversations, and he's also been on our podcast long ago.
Episode 8 from season 1.
Oh,
when we still had seasons, and it is one of my favorite episodes, so
go listen to that if you haven't yet.
It's profound. That episode stuck with me for a really long time, and it's also one of the episodes that I bring up a lot in conversations around solastalgia and home
and the environment. It also really like stuck with me. So anyways, we'll have him on again one time.
We'll have a South Korea episode.
And so we had a conversation about productivity, because he is now in South Korea and working full-time. He also used to be a student. And he often also just asks me, like, you know, what philosophical topic are you reading about? What's happening? And then he brought up the conversation about productivity. Just very casually to think about, oh, that's what happened. He asked me, are you bored often? Mm. How often are you bored? And how does boredom feel to you?
Mm.
And then I've always seen being bored as like a virtuous activity. Like, it's not
one of the few.
It's not a problem that needs to be, well, this is how I think about it, but how I act is different. It's like boredom is not like, boredom isn't necessarily a thing that you need to solve. It's always kind of this gateway to more fun other things, but I find myself often avoiding being bored for long enough to actually tap into that space
of inspiration.
So I've always liked this idea of, like, you know, the art of doing nothing, just being able to sit as a kind of counter productivity narrative.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there's this thing of like almost how the society asks of us to measure everything in productivity language.
What have
even
you done
your
today
boredom.
Or,
So even a friend that I made recently is like taking some time off of work, and then I heard someone else asking her, so, and it's literally been a week, and they were like, have you learned any new skills? And I was like, it's been a week. Like, and it's the same with what we had in the pandemic, where we had this time off, this moment to sit still, and then productivity and skills and achievement became a metric again.
And it became a different kind of metric, in the sense where now it's about, can you bake the best sourdough, and can you rearrange your entire home? And that kind of productivity often made me think of the solastalgia episode with Rue, where it's like when we are at home and we have nothing to do, we actually confront it with ourselves for the first time, because we're always so busy. And then it's kind of a distraction of all the debris of not processing emotions and things come up when you're not doing something.
Yeah.
And then doing things over the weekend is also a distraction of just being with yourself. It's almost like we're afraid of intimacy with ourselves and distract ourselves through that.
Yeah, 100%. Because, like, I find myself doing nothing a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't find myself enjoying that necessarily.
Is there always an anxiety connected to it?
Yeah, so I think it's because of that. There's this feeling of if it's just doing nothing, but maybe it's out of procrastination, then there's a guilt piece to it. Or if it's and sometimes being bored or not working or counter working or whatever you want to call it isn't necessarily just sitting still. No. Like, also this false perception of what should we do when we do nothing?
Yes.
Like, what does it mean to do nothing? Is doing nothing, you know, working in the garden?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I always think of, I think we also spoke about it when we spoke about Afrikaner femininity.
Oh my God, this is what I just want to say. I'm really glad we're talking about this topic because I have a million things to say already.
It's like this thing of always keeping busy. And
I'm fascinated by when you go and visit an Afrikaner home, specifically the wife, and this kind of like constant busyness. And we've spoken about our parents, our moms a lot, because I think both of our moms have this thing of like, there's constantly something that needs to be cleaned or arranged or needs to be fixed in the house or done. But then also when you're relaxing, it's like, okay, so people come over and then you sit and you put out the snacks. And before they come, you like clean the whole space and you prepare everything. And then they come and you sit and you take out the snacks. And then you get up and you pour them drinks. And then it's now time to braai.
And then you make the salad. And then back away again.
Exactly. And then immediately after eating, you pack the dishwasher and you prepare like the pudding. And then when the pudding comes, then after that it's like the tea, and then the wife prepares the tea, and then that funny moment of her, the men jump up and take the tray. But everything else has been like faffing and running around the whole time. And I immediately now, when you started talking, thought about how in my research at the moment I'm looking a lot at what were the things Afrikaner women were encouraged to keep themselves busy with during apartheid that basically made them politically inactive because they were so busy with this domestic realm. And I often think of, I don't know if I'm repeating myself because this I've said in my life a lot in the last few months. I watched that show, Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey. I don't know if you've heard about that. So it's on Netflix and it's about the Mormon group in America that kind of went a little bit crazy and close to Texas or in Texas had a almost like a cult space, and some really crazy stuff went down there. But before they went so crazy, or when they started going so crazy, the guy that changed the rules made the requirements for women's dress, like how they should look and be presentable in the outdoor space, so intense that they had like 12 hairdos they could choose from, but each hairdo was like a 50 million plait. You know, like the plaits have literally the plaits have like 30 string things, you know, they're so complex to do that in the documentary the women were reflecting after they came out of the cult and went through their rehabilitation and everything, that it took them about 2 hours in the morning just to get ready to be able to go out of the house. So that idea of what is it that we keep ourselves busy with, and why do we have this feeling to keep ourselves busy with it all the time? And I feel like our generation is still processing a lot of what our parents and our grandparents' generation were doing during apartheid in terms of keeping yourself busy, because the way that I was trained as a woman, Afrikaner woman, was also that you need to constantly maintain this kind of relaxed, comfortable, peaceful home environment. And if you're not cleaning and organizing, you should be making pillows or making clothes or making something that can add to that like domestic bliss space.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that, then you should be resourceful. So then you must pickle every goddamn thing that there's a harvest of lemons. So you must make some lemon vinegar or something, you know, that there's always something to do within the domestic space. And it comes from that keeping women busy with other things so that they can't challenge the systems.
Yeah.
And women policed each other in that through the RCF fear and those kind of...
Yes, like our grand... If like my grandmother also like has that history of being so busy with all these committees and flower arranging and making little bracelets for children in this type of need and all of those busy work. And then at the same time, it's fascinating to me if you look at now just the history of labor and how labor and work has been so different for people, even in the feminist movement, like when especially white feminists were saying, you know, like, we want equality, we want to go back to work, really talking about the limitations of that being at home, as you just said,
yeah.
being so apolitical, not being able to be involved,
yeah.
fighting for that. And then a group of black women in America said, but, you know, this is not a relatable understanding of work for us, because we've always been working,
yeah,
you know, another type of labor,
yeah.
labor that stems from like kind of the
slavery
period,
yeah.
and that intense connection between black femininity and work, but work for white people, for the community, for the plantation,
yeah.
to it's also in this community, but it's kind of interesting how white women and black women had this differing experience
yeah.
of work.
Yeah.
Obviously that's now a generalization, but it just also reminded me of like this kind of how they exist together, the
yes.
apoliticalness and the very much
and then also,
forced entrenched
yeah.
labor that came at a certain historic period for a lot
yeah.
of women specifically, and men obviously.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is also to think now, this is what I'm thinking about now, is how can these domestic care labor acts be political acts? Like, how can I use the medium of knitting and crocheting and embroidering to speak about the stuckness in that kind of femininity? Because what I realized was I overextended a bit when I became conscious of like the feminist narrative and rejected a part of myself that really enjoys those things.
Yeah.
And then kind of discovered meditation as if I'm like the only person ever in the world meditating.
White girl discovers
yes,
meditation.
Exactly. And then can't stop talking about it because obviously it's amazing. But then I remember making kimchi a few months ago, and when I make a big batch of kimchi, it takes like a day,
mm.
but sometimes even 2 days. And it's literally like chopping and peeling the whole day. And then thought all of a sudden of how this is such an act of meditation, and how my grandmothers, when they made jams and things, they knew about domestic meditation before me.
Yeah.
You know, it was like it wasn't made such a big thing. But how it can be this kind of peaceful and integrated act that we don't have to reject simply because it's associated with women, and that as a feminist I can still do that, or I mean associated with the suppression of women.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what you said about the white women and feminists asking to have this kind of equality in the workspace and also wanting to work the same. We had an interesting conversation in the house the other day about how one of our friends are now after a break back in the corporate world, and he was saying how he was observing the women in the space there really adopting all of the attitudes that come from a patriarchal system of work, and it's kind of seen as this boss bitch
mm.
kind of lifestyle. But he said how apparent it became to him that they're also just now in the same situation of not being in touch with their feelings, in touch with the environment, in touch with all of these things, and really asking himself, and then also asking us, like, what is actually the benefits of women being equal in the workspace but adopting the same system that we are kind of wanting to fight through
yeah.
feminism, you know?
Exactly.
And just kind of embodying this quote-unquote masculine way of working in the workspace,
mm-hmm.
instead of bringing, you know, what is lacking by, you know, taking out different kinds of people in the workspace, and instead of inviting the diversity of voice and experience and all of that, it's kind of like how women now want to prove that they can do this, so then just follow the system as is.
Yeah, yeah. And also like that obviously puts a lot of burden on the individual woman or
yeah.
person who is now in this work system and trying
yeah.
to and thinking that you alone have this kind of ability to now shift
change
this
it.
Whole
yeah,
system where it's evident that the patriarchal capitalist system work very well together, like
yeah.
they kind of like
no they're
go
best
hand
friends.
And they're besties, they hold hands and it's not surprising that the workspace still demands like
yeah.
have these demands and a lot of women who are maybe also mothers or whatever just don't have the choice. Like, you know, you are kind of forced into this way of like wanting to.
And I don't know if it was you or if it was a different friend, but a different friend told me recently she was so upset because she joined a company which has period leave, but no one takes it. And I was like, what is happening that we have these beautiful things now granted and acknowledged? Because I am the kind of person that really can't work when I'm on my period. And I have absolutely no shame to admit that I take off in that time. I lie in bed. And it is just because there's so much going on in my body and I honor it. And I don't even feel like I need to justify it. You know, it's like it's just something that I do and afford myself because I can. I work for myself. But now a corporation acknowledges that you can take this leave. I think it's 3 or 4 days a month. Which is fabulous. Yeah. And then she said that no one takes it in the company. And there's kind of this like almost the perpetuated shame of if you are now the only one that takes it, everyone else that also kind of wants to take it will be a little bit jealous and mad and sad and sour about you taking it. But they don't want to claim it because, I don't know. I mean, what do you think is the idea behind that?
Yeah, I have no idea why people won't take it, because if I had that opportunity, I would definitely take it. But
I mean, I can imagine that it's just also it's so personal to have to acknowledge to your corporation and to your HR.
And to maybe still even like my experience a little bit of working in a semi-corporate environment was also, even though those opportunities are there, it sometimes just feels like a hassle when you take it, or you they've made the rule that like you can do it, but do they really adapt in terms of the workload you need to produce? So oftentimes I also felt like even if I have an off day, like we had this thing also, one day in a year you can take a personal admin day, and it's seen as this like amazing benefit, you know. We have personal admin day. It's like, who only has personal admin for one day? Like, how can you do all your personal admin in one day? Like, what? Everyone does personal admin the whole time at work, but now there's this day, and they are just so fantastic because they gave it. But even when you take a personal admin day, you suffer the next day at work because the deadlines are still the same. You have to catch up. So I'm thinking, in a way, while it's seen as a benefit, a lot of women might experience then just having to overcompensate even more after taking that time, because that time off is not really time off. It's just, it's like sick leave as well. It's sometimes like it's time away.
You have to, you have to catch up.
Or before you go on leave. That's always such an interesting, that was such an interesting period for me, because I felt like before I can go on my leave, I have to work like twice as hard to get everything done for leave. And then the holiday is like less exciting because you go into it with so much stress and you're so exhausted. So that definitely taught me about, like, made me very cynical about all these corporate gestures when it comes to acknowledging rest.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm now thinking there's this Instagram page, and I think it's someone who wrote the book. We can Google it, but it's called Rest is Resistance. And it's this whole movement.
Yeah.
And I think it's also run by Black women who acknowledge the burden of work that are almost in their bodies from the period of slavery and before, and how this constant need to hustle and work and be strong, like that thing of like Black women are strong and we can do it, and you know, we can just navigate everything. And to say that actually we live in a time where if you can really carve out time to rest, and I'm still vague on what that rest would look like or means, but that there's a big piece of resistance in that.
Yes.
And the way I applied that is just by not in my job necessarily always working the hours that's expected of me, or taking a longer lunch, or that is kind of like that beats this whole idea around productivity and how you need to spend your day.
Yeah.
Because in a way, productivity, that's what my brother...
Sorry, let me just get Diego. It's fine. You can we'll pause. Keep it in.
Go, Diego. Diego
is the cutest dog, and he's like trying to lie by our feet.
Come on here.
Diego,
leave it.
Oh.
Settle.
Diego is just bummed about all the work that is expected of him. Maybe dogs have the key to what we are trying to figure out.
In terms
they
of
know
rest.
About rest.
Yeah, and how to relax. Sorry, I disrupted your point there. Now I hope he stays
no, it's
quiet.
Fine.
But I wanted to link. It's not the same at all in terms of what you're saying from the kind of residue fatigue almost from slavery. But I was also thinking about I have a tendency to overwork, because I'm my passion. I'm so passionate about art, and my passion is my work. I had to really reflect on, you know, how to put up boundaries for myself to actually see that overwork is a form of self-abandonment. And I did
let's unpack that quickly. Overwork is a form of self-abandonment.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
So if I need rest and I deny that I need rest and I work, it's a form of abandoning my needs and not taking care of myself in that instance for some reason or story of idea of success.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost the opposite of self-love. So how the rest, and it's not self-hate necessarily, because we're not always so, I'm not always so conscious about why I make the decisions to overwork. It kind of just happens. But when I then afterwards in the fatigue go and reflect on it, there's often some kind of fear or insecurity that pushed me to overextend and overcompensate almost, and kind of cross my own boundaries. So when I looked into why I do this, I also inquired into my ancestral line and kind of the patterning of the women in my life that I grew up around. And like I said, my mom has this constant thing of doing. And what was interesting to notice was that her form of accomplishment almost, or what I, she doesn't think or preach this philosophy, but it's in the way that she worked in her life. I kind of learned this belief that from her, or saw this pattern, which I then also do. So what often happens when I overwork is my back gets sore, and I get really fatigued and tired physically, and it often goes with like physical pain.
Yeah.
And then realized one day that my mom is a caterer, and when she would get a really big job, she would work herself like to the bone and then come home feeling really accomplished, plop down on the couch and then complain about her back being sore. So from a very young age, this idea of success, accomplishment and being productive to me was tied to physical fatigue.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes. So to then see that I almost don't feel like I've accomplished something in the day if I don't feel physically tired.
Yeah.
And also, for example, can't see that in this time when I needed to rest, I was really sick now for 3 weeks and I needed to take that rest. I was actually doing work in terms of recharging to do the work. So this is what I spoke about in the webinar that I did this week as well, about the creative blocks and the creative winter that we're in, and the importance of creative rest. So I can expand on that just now. But then in this inquiry and seeing my mom, I then went in and looked at my grandmother on my mom's side, and she also worked herself to the bone her entire life. And it was also because there was lack in their lives. So my grandmother and grandfather wasn't extremely wealthy, and she grew up with her mother came out of the Depression. So I'll talk about my great-grandmother now. But my grandmother used to get up 4 a.m. in the morning, bake about 30 to 50 cakes and cookies and soot cookies and cook sisters and kolwankies and like you can pastaikies and all
the
kinds of
bizarre,
exactly
your...
think of a tuisnuiverite. That was my grandmother's house. She basically begged for all the tuisnuiverite. I don't know what a tuisnuiverite is in English, but it's basically the place where you buy
like a bakery
or you buy all this stuff. So she,
that word even, tuisnuiverite, like home industry,
yes, you're right.
So almost that industrial work
of the domestic life,
in the domestic, is actually so fascinating because it operates like
exactly
a machine. You wake up, you clock in, you go.
So she woke up at 4 a.m, would bake all the cakes, and then they obviously have to cool down and before she can ice them. So she'd go to bed again, sleep for about an hour, get up at like 7, 8, ice all the cakes, and then start her delivery route. And then she would go and work at the, they had a kaffir.
Mm-hmm.
What's a kaffir in Evankel? Shop. But a kaffir is also like, it's almost like a convenience store. They had store. Where you had like all your things, and then she would go work there, and then she would go to bed at night around 9, 10, and then start at 4 again every single day. Like, this is how I knew her for years and years and years, until she couldn't anymore. And then I once asked my mom about this kind of almost work ethic, I want to call it, but it's not a work ethic, there's no ethic in it, I feel. Self-ethic at least. And then she said, well, my grandmother's mother used to, they're both from the Karoo, my family's from the Karoo, so my great-grandmother used to boil soap, boeresiep, in the sun in the Karoo every single day of her life. And my mom just showed me this gesture of my grandmother with this massive pot. That's how she remembers her and the stories of, like, you know, kind of like churning this massive fat pot, like, and making this
muscle,
the massive arms, and but also being in that sun and like doing that every day. And where it's all of these tasks that are rooted actually in our creative expression. If you think of baking, if you think of soap making, it's, to me, it's very practical but creative acts.
Yeah.
But because they did that for a living, there was this overcompensation of working themselves, you know, like completely kaput. And then there's this song, we must actually maybe try and find it and play it at the end. Okay. It's called Worth Ethic. So worth? Not work ethic, worth ethic.
Okay.
And this woman is like a rap song, and she says, I'm a hydrated woman. And it's like all these like affirmations of how your work ethic needs to be a worth ethic. There's a big shift that happened for me there. But that what you mentioned about the kind of lineage of working just related to me to this story of like how I had to inquire into my own lineage of working to understand my patterns around productivity and success.
Yeah. And in a way, reconcile it with the with the times we are in now, where you're saying you are almost, like, I love that, how you are reappropriating these types of work, but in a more worth ethic fashion,
and a sustainable and in a more way.
Politically involved point of expression as well,
and also to understand that the history of our country and our families have an influence on the patterning of how we work. Because my mother didn't grow up in the Great Depression. My grandmother, I think, experienced parts of it. I can't remember when the Great Depression was, to be honest, but anyway, I can't make the calculation, so I'm very bad with history. But my great grandmother, and so that had a ripple into my generation, still seeing the same patterns perpetuated of, you know, that there's a lack in it, and that almost, I am extremely resourceful, which is amazing, and I know this to be an asset I have.
Yeah.
But the resourcefulness originally came out of this fear of lack and not having. And now having to ask myself, is it really necessary for me to walk around with socks that have holes in and try to patch them because of resourcefulness?
Yeah.
Or is there a way to recycle? And, you know, so there's this fine line between the sustainability and resourcefulness, and also like living with this constant fear of going into lack and not having enough, which then kind of forces you into overworking when it's not necessarily needed.
Yeah.
You know? So I just want to mention that the truck, the garbage truck is coming, and this is Frida, our other dog's arch enemy. So she's running up and down making a scene.
Like every week it's
she
an
hates
event.
This truck.
But yeah, like, I think the that's what I also wanted to say earlier, is like, it's weird how the notion of, if you think about productivity, my association with working, to work productive, is almost like the word effective as well. Like, if you are really being productive, you can almost work less.
Yes.
Like, it's like you benut your tijd. You are like so productive.
Resourceful with your time.
And resourceful in your time that you almost optimize rest. That's what you would, that's how, like, ideally it can work in a way. But that also has such a skewed understanding of, you know, work. And it's at, like, all these popular culture phenomenon, like the 5 a.m. club. I'm thinking of that now. It's like, what's a book that? by someone.
5 a.m.
5 a.m. And I'm thinking of your grandmother as well. Yeah. This like morning, it's like a 1 hour morning ritual.
Yeah.
Where like the first 20 minutes you do news and meditation, and then 20 minutes you do exercise.
I believe in that.
I mean, I'm not saying those things are bad, but what I'm saying is that those skills and like waking up at 5 every morning, and it's part of a broader productivity money making. Yes.
It's not about having a morning ritual because it's going to stabilize in your day. It's about having a morning ritual to stabilize in your day so you can be a productive human.
How can you set yourself up so that you can work as effectively and make as much money while attaining some sense of holistic, healthy being?
Yeah.
But I don't know, something about that is just so ironic to me of like,
but to me, this is what the whole spiritual movement, mindfulness movement now in the commercial sense is also doing.
Yeah.
It's like, meditate so that you can go back to the job where you work yourself fucked and be more mindful while you're working yourself fucked. You know, like, I mean, I don't really understand. There's so much coming up for me. This is going to be a 3-hour episode.
I also want to feel like I want to go back also to what you've now just described. Let's pause with your the lineage of work that you are talking about, because I find that so fascinating.
Yes.
And I also have similar, I haven't delved in it to such a deep level as you have, but I also have similar, I recall being as like just out of high school and like starting university, like the ultimate virtue for me was to be busy. And also that thing that you said with your mom being like, if I can tell people that I'm basically too busy to do anything, and it's almost, there's such a like sense of superiority that I attach to being busy and just going things and being in all these, like, I think my way of that was also being in all these different committees where you have this sense of maybe like social impact, but it's actually just like all these little social events where you plan things and organize things. That also, that kind of planning capacity work, that
admin,
that is exactly just modern versions of those, like Funkelfrau, what is it? That all have very fascinating like histories in terms of, as you said now, the apartheid history and all of that. But I still experience a lot of adults and a lot of, I hear a lot of people brag about busyness.
Yeah.
And now it's a very off-putting.
It was really frustrating to me when, okay, wait, let me first say one thing. Because you were saying about, what was the phrase, like something like optimizing race or something like that. I was saying yesterday in the webinar that people often say that music is made as much with the pauses between the notes as the notes. And I understand the creative process to be the same. The creative process is made as much about, like, the act of creating as not creating and resting.
Yeah.
And they fit into each other really beautifully if you understand when you're resting, you're actually doing creative work as well.
That's so profound, especially in Afrikaans where it's literally a rusnoot. If you play like piano, like on, if you read music, then it's the rest
notes. So the I look at the pauses as productive as well, but productive in a healthy sense, you know, like when I say productive, it's like it's always within the bracket of sustainability. So that's the one thing I wanted to flag about, like, thinking about the rest as the resnuete, you know, as the, because you need that, otherwise it won't exist. Yeah.
Or like if you sing, like you can't breathe to finish the song if you don't take a rest.
Exactly. Yeah. And then something I noticed when I finished studying, because I have this understanding of creativity, which I worked through while I was in Korea, and kind of go listen to the first episode of my podcast.
Can we take a moment? I wanted to do it in the beginning. Nicolene started a podcast. Guys, this is so exciting. I've been like waiting for this forever, even before we started airing.
It was the original podcast I wanted to start. Yeah, so in Korea, I told Yana about this idea to do NB Art Notes, and then it became Airit Podcast, and now I finally started NB Art Notes.
We need to do like This episode is sponsored by NB Art Notes.
NB Art Notes can sponsor fuck all at the moment, but it's definitely endorsed by whatever.
Yeah.
So anyway, in the first episode of the podcast, I talk at length about this whole process of getting to this understanding of sustainable creativity. So you can go listen there to understand the background
and
of this.
And don't listen when you think you want to rest, because I thought I would... not to offend Nicolene, but I was struggling to sleep, and then I wanted to listen to the podcast anyways. And Nicolene has such a soothing meditation voice, especially when she speaks on her own. Like, and I was like, this is gonna be excellent. Like, I can listen to it and hopefully
and fall asleep.
I will fall asleep, not because of
I'm
boredom,
offended by that.
Just because of your voice. And I would have listened to the rest later, but then I was just so captivated, and I listened to both episodes like straight after each other. It was amazing.
Without
I
sleeping.
Can't yeah. It was
not
it was
resting.
It was naive of me to think that you could ever put me to sleep. But anyways, you have to go listen.
Yeah, so when like getting to the understanding of the sustainability of creativity happened like right after varsity, and then when I came back, now seeing like a lot of the colleagues and people that worked with me at varsity, and that I know they all started working now. And then there was a particular party, which I'm not going to mention the particularity of it because you were also there, so you'll know.
Okay.
The background. I'll tell you afterwards because I don't want to offend the people that I'm talking about now, because I also know it's a process. But I was really triggered, which was just a reflection of my own insecurity about how I work still then, by everyone complaining about how overworked they were and about the system of overworking, and kind of having this really woke quote-unquote conversation about the work environment, and yet perpetuating the structure of it because they still felt insecure, all being BA students and all like, you know, just entering this job field and feeling like they want to prove their worth and having this you know complex of not feeling worthy as a creative, and then overworking in order to compensate for that. Because then I asked, well, I mean, why do you work after hours if you, and then yes, but the deadlines and this and that, and I do want my work to be on standard. And then just also seeing how we can have a conversation about working, but implementing it and resting is really hard, you know, like actually not being in that space because, like you say, with the period situation, taking the off time when no one else is taking it also makes you feel strange sometimes.
And disadvantaged in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's definitely where there are some myths about what it means to work and be busy and 8 hours a day, even if it's just an 8-hour standard. Like when I worked from home in the pandemic times, like I felt very confused about what is really expected of me. And then when I thought about it, it was like, if we were to be in an office, there's always time for like office chats and like a lot of people don't work
consistently,
but somehow
you have to be there though.
There's this message, and when I spoke to all my colleagues about it, they also experienced this pressure of like, and it was a writing and research job, and like to write and do that for 8 hours straight is nearly impossible, but still everyone like aspire to do that as a norm. So letting go of that is really helpful, and I think that's also where I'm now navigating, because I was just thinking, like, isn't there like a philosopher that I can turn to in terms of work? And like you were speaking about the art part of it, but doing a PhD and working and being like kind of exposed to academia also has a lot of triggers and unlearning in terms of that busyness, work culture. That, and even if I think about all the quote-unquote great philosophers, it's all these like prolific people, like same with artists, like the level that of things that they produce, like imagine like writing like 30 books, and it's all just so
I have some insight into, just because you're speaking about philosophers now, so I just wanted to bring up this practice called slow motion multitasking, which is a practice that there's a TED talk about it where the person goes into more detail about it. But in my research around sustainable creativity, I stumbled across this philosophy and practice. And slow motion multitasking is basically having multiple projects open at the same time, and you can think of them as boxes. And as soon as you reach a stuck point in the one, you start feeling fatigued in the one, you jump to the next. But they need to be kind of different from each other. You can't jump from one paper on, what's the word I want to say? Your master's word.
Allyship.
You can't jump from one paper on allyship to another paper on allyship. Yeah. It needs to be like from allyship to kimchi, you know, like that, which is something that I've adopted in my life and which is why I think I am so productive in a healthy sense now, because I have multiple projects that stimulate me. So if I sit and write and I start getting stuck, then I can go and embroider, or I can go and paint, or I can make kimchi, or I can, you know, I have all these things that I'm interested in. And the person that they use as an example of that was Darwin.
Yeah.
And Darwin did slow motion multitasking, where he, for his entire life, had this like kind of worm that he studied and played with. Mm. After he like did his research in the evenings, he would go and like look at this worm. I think it's an earthworm. I don't know what kind of worm it is. But anyway, so he like had this worms that he like played with, and everyone thought like, ugh, this is now just like his hobby. And then at the end of his life, he finally released a book on this worm, which was like, according to the person that did the talk, like one of his most profound works, and it was like this idea of, it's not quickly multitasking. It's not multitasking in the sense that we understand it, of like being on your phone and writing and driving and like all of the things at the same time. It's more you focus on one thing until you start feeling that kind of like, I can't focus on this anymore. And then you move to the other thing. And if you practice this, you'll see that the insights that you get from the one area really bleeds into the other project, even if they don't. Like, I mean, what can kimchi teach me about painting? But it has, you know, I have insights from kimchi about painting.
Name and one.
I can. So that it takes fucking long, you know, like that you need patience. And I can speak about the fermentation process of ideas and how all the flavors blend together the longer you sit with it, you know.
Yeah.
And so they do, it does help to kind of have multiple things that you're interested in, and then slowly move over to the next and to the next and to the next. And in the talk, they also talk about this specific artist or theorist that physically had boxes that she like kept things in. So when she had an idea, she would categorize it and then put it in the box. And then if she needed inspiration, she'd run to that box and go and unpack the box. So to have this kind of mental different boxes that you jump to helps me a lot.
Yeah, that's also, I'm thinking of the episode we did with Professor Louise Tutoi, my supervisor, where we spoke about Gandhi.
Yeah.
And she also shared, I mean, he was also like very prolific and in terms of output and work, but also his non-negotiables of like how far he walked every day and that he like
tapestries?
Yeah. Did like a veel. Die ding met die veel doen. Like doring. But anyway, like all of these.
Spun wool.
I don't know what you call it.
Thread. Made thread.
He had a different type of spinning class in the morning. But, you know, like that kind of. It's fascinating to hear about all these people and like how they do these things, as you said, that might seem completely arbitrary, but that actually enables some. And I mean, it's not like everything should be in service of this one work or output. No. Like, it can have intrinsic value as well.
Which is, maybe let's return to the morning rituals, because I'm a massive fan of a morning ritual, which I practice maybe 50% of the time, but I preach it 100% of the time. Like, I, in my life, when I practiced the morning rituals and the evening rituals the most was in Korea, and that's, I think, when I was mentally like the most healthy after being so depressed, you know. But I needed it a lot then. But what I know and notice in myself and know from other people as well is that the rise of social media has, besides giving us constantly something to do, and then we don't get bored because you can always make a post or make a story or go and check someone else's content, it also takes away that pause in the morning where Sarah Blondin, one of this meditation teachers that I listen to often, her podcast is called Live Awake. It's really beautiful. She writes in her diary, she had burnout and then moved to the forest with her husband and her baby, and then went into a depression because of this isolation, boredom, because she realized everything in her life that she didn't deal with when she was in corporate world caught up with her. And then she started quote unquote healing herself. I just want to say, when I say healing, I mean becoming whole. And when I say becoming whole, I mean accepting all of yourself.
Okay.
So that doesn't mean that, you know, you need to fix things about yourself. It more it needs, you need to self accept things. Yeah. You know? So she went through this process of self healing or becoming whole or acceptance through writing these beautiful diary entries, which she reads. And this is her meditations. It's really stunning. I'm sure I've sent you one in the past. She has a very meditative
mother. God. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, so then, why was I speaking about? Oh, Sarah Blondin says that every night we fall asleep, it's like we die a little death. Okay. And then we forget everything about the I and the self and all of these roles and all of these things about ourselves and all the to-do lists and everything. And then in the morning, it's like we turn to our bedside table and we pick it all up and we put it on again.
Okay, and like you get dressed in yourself almost.
Exactly. And what I feel if I practice my morning ritual is that that almost amnesia of all of the things that I carry with me gets extended. You know, when I write about my dreams or I do a brain dump or whatever, I extend that amnesia that the night affords us, and I can choose more easily what it is that I want to adopt in the day again, what I want to put on. But if I just grab my phone immediately, it throws me into the character that I play every day automatically. And then there's not that sense of pause.
Yeah.
So basically what meditation in the mornings give me is a practice of pausing throughout the day. And what I notice when I practice meditation more often is that when I sit in line somewhere, when I'm in traffic, or when I have pauses in between, I've practiced to pause, so I don't have to grab the next thing.
That
so meditation is just the practice to pause. It's like Susan Sontag Salzburg is her name. I can't remember her name now. Her surname, but Susan Salzburg. Anyway, she's also one of my favorite meditation teachers, and she says that meditation is the moment when you get lost in the noise and you remember to come return to your breath or whatever. That is the practice. The practice is acknowledging that you got lost and then returning, coming back.
Yeah, that you once also shared a course with me on meditation, yes, where that was also...
That was probably by her.
Yeah, it could be.
But she, but so that idea that if we have a ritual in the morning where we pause before just plunging into our day, we're basically practicing resting in between, because then there is this sense of spaciousness, this vastness in our being, which we can return to throughout the day.
Yeah, I love that idea. And I think you told me once, because we were also talking about morning rituals, and I was kind of contemplating what my morning ritual could look like. And then I think you told me, like, you have a morning ritual, whether you want to admit it or not.
Yes.
It's just maybe not
a great ritual, one.
A great one. It's, and then like, I started realizing, like, it's not, even if you, because I think I used to say, like, you know, I'm someone who struggles to keep a ritual and to be so consistent with it. But I am consistent with a ritual.
Yes.
It's maybe just not one
gulping down your coffee while you're looking at your phone.
Screen,
yeah.
Going to the laptop immediately. And then I also realized that the ritual can be, like, I can have agency in terms
curated
of what I want. So
let me give them a little practical how to form a morning ritual.
Okay.
So Tim Ferriss did a thing about morning rituals where he said that you choose five things. So say you say for yourself that you're going to do half an hour, 45 minutes, or an hour. You can choose. Then to create that sense of flexibility and creativity, you make a list of five things you'd like to do. And then on any given morning, you do three. And if you do five, amazing. But it's not about doing all five. It's about having the option to scale down or scale up. And then you choose. So then he said to have a kind of a mindful practice, and then to have an exercise, and then to have a writing practice, and then to, what was there's other nourishment that you can do, like body practice. And I can't remember the fifth one now.
Reading? No.
It could be. Yes, it could be reading. But then also to separate the reading that we do for our work from the, you know, like kind of, yes, it was like a kind of studying, but it's a self-studying to like better yourself almost. Or like, ugh, I don't like what I said now. Not better yourself, but you know,
What I mean. Yeah,
but so what's lovely about this then is if you combine it, which is my kind of thing, I believe in multi-century rituals. So if you consistently drink the same tea in the morning, so say you choose mint tea, and you burn the same scent in the morning, and you play the same soundtrack in the morning. Now, it doesn't have to be the same soundtrack for your entire life, but you can have a playlist. Your mind associates that multi-sensory experience with what it is that you intend to do. So this is also the ritual that I create, a ritual that I kind of introduce to my clients when they struggle to start, is create a multi-sensory ritual for your studio space, because then eventually your mind starts associating it with that kind of quote-unquote productive creative space. So that's just a little, if you want to invest in a morning ritual, which can really glide you into your day.
That advice has really helped me craft my own one as well. I don't have the smell bit yet, but the rest.
You don't like incense?
I don't.
Candles that have scent?
A little bit, but yeah, I think maybe I just like the smell of my garden at the moment.
But that's sort of fabulous. Like, it's not
a created smell. But because I think a part of me thinks when that comes in, it won't be as sustainable for me, because it's not something that I gravitate to
the scent
creating.
Well, I think
scent.
That there is sense that the same with the ritual, there is sense that you gravitate to. Maybe you just don't associate them as like a scent that you burn or something. So maybe like cinnamon, or it can you know, even be a spice that you really like, or I'm sure the smell of fresh bread.
Butter. melting butter melting on toast can be my morning scent.
So there's this, I haven't watched the movie, but there's this movie called Der Witch or something like that. It's a German movie, and my friend always says that the devil in that movie says to the one girl, like, give me your soul for the taste of butter in your mouth and silk dresses. And then we always say we've sold our soul already to the devil for butter and silk dresses.
That's hilarious. But yeah, on the back to the or like
work.
The let's work. No, but I think that part that you said about the morning ritual, what it allows you, is almost a sense of training to rest,
come back to yourself,
training to do nothing where nothing isn't, you know, meaningless. It's not arbitrary. It's not like vague.
This is what I wanted to say when you said this earlier as well about rest not being necessarily doing nothing. Is Stuart Brown's definition of play for adults is time spent without purpose. Any activity that doesn't have a productive purpose is seen as play, actually. And as adults, we don't play. So to spend time in the garden is a form of playing, but you are looking at the flowers and the birds and the, you know, you're resting. Even if you're gardening, and it's not because you want to have the perfect garden in the next month and it needs to look in a certain way. It's a time spent without purpose, in the sense of you're just kind of doing it. So to afford yourself that sense of play, if rest can be seen as play in that way.
And that's why I think like walking is also a great example of this, where a lot of people have spoken about, you know, walking also has that meditative quality to it, the repetition, you are busy but you're not, and you focus certain things and pick up certain things and encounter certain people, especially when you can walk non-directionally, when you just
wanderlust. We did a whole workshop at a varsity about wanderlust, where we had to wander around in Stellenbosch, because our painting teacher at that point was wandering around everywhere. So he was like, I'm just going to make them wander around and make art out of it.
But it does have like I also have the privilege of doing that kind of any time of the day, and it's always fascinating for me to like go at like 11 o'clock in the morning or whatever, to see like who walks around. Well, in my suburb there's always people walking around, but that is also for me a form of like rest. Some kind of resting, pausing, not, especially if it can be, as I said, like without purpose.
And have you listened to the TED Talk on boredom? Because I wanted to say that in the beginning of the podcast, but also forgot. Have you?
No, I don't think I have.
So it was quite cool that you started with that, because I, with the same time when I researched the multitask situation, slow motion multitasking, I got this podcast, and it's all about creativity and kind of work and how important it is to spend downtime. So maybe I'll go to the creative winter soon as well. But this woman basically says that when why do we get the best ideas on the toilet, in the shower, in a walk, in traffic. It's because when our mind goes to autopilot and we're not thinking about something specifically, it's actually doing a lot of processing of our subconscious mind. And it pieces together things that we can't do with the conscious mind. We can't think ideas all the time. They kind of have to pop up, and we're like, they come so mysteriously, but it's from this archive of things that we're constantly taking in. And that's why it's so important to do nothing, because that processing needs to happen.
Yeah.
So you need to craft, if you're a creative, time off to do this kind of non-directional thing that puts your mind into autopilot. That's why when I'm stuck in an art piece, I go and make kimchi.
Yeah.
Because that kind of meditative automatic task often leads me to breakthroughs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the what she then said is that if you now on the toilet sit on social media or on read a book or whatever, and don't pretend like you don't do that. I know most people do.
Yeah.
It's disgusting, but we all do it. you take that time away for your mind to learn to rest and do that. And that's also why when we read content, and like I'm doing right now, and we look up out on a landscape, I think Margot told me this, or you told me that. Yeah, there's a kind of brain processing that also happens, which is a kind of integration of the knowledge that is here right now. It's a kind of, can you remember how she's framed it? Because I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, but I think what you said is right. It's like when you look up and are able to see a horizon or something like that, then your brain integrates what you take in better. And I mean, I find myself doing that all the time. When you read a few sentences and then you look up and you stare a bit, and it's a weird stare. It's not like you're looking at something and then you go back, and then it's like that type of processing that happens.
So that's similar to the process that happens when we do these kind of automatic tasks and our brain is on autopilot. So the boredom TED Talk's quite a good one to listen to as a spin-off of this episode, because she speaks about, I think she even speaks about like how much time your brain needs in that restful state in order to have better ideas. And then it got me thinking about how quote-unquote dangerous it is that we live in a world where we are constantly occupied and not having these kind of innovative ideas, you know. So I try to practice bed hygiene. I'm terrible at it, but it's just the thing Tabu and I have adopted saying it. But I'm the one that forces it. I like get into the room at night and I'm like, bed hygiene! like he just put his phone away. And it's just, it's about crafting a space where your mind associates it simply with rest and love making, potentially, if you have a partner, but also to have that kind of like restful space and not bring your laptop to your bed and all of that, so that it's not a work and a did and a did.
Yeah.
And we felt that in the pandemic as well,
how
important it is to kind of separate spaces for rest and
That's something I really struggle with as well. But definitely as you describe, what did you say now? You said something about boredom. It's funny because Nicolene and I were talking about redecorating her lounge earlier, but
not redecorating, not shifting it around.
Restyling.
I also cut my hair this morning. It has to happen.
I need to cut her hair after this episode as well. Which think about us.
Fix some things.
But it's funny how, like, I always, if I sit still and I, let's say, like, practice boredom unintentionally, like it happens and I'm bored and I'm like, what? Like that happened to me last night during load shedding as well. It's also an interesting thing that we
experience. I love load shedding. I know everyone hates it, but I love it because that's when my dad used to read his poetry at night and everyone comes together.
Yeah.
I feel like
there
South Africa is
the candles
more,
come in, yeah.
Yes, I feel like South Africa is more connected because of load shedding.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because we can just switch off the lights ourselves, but that forced moments of pause, there is something to it. But it's funny how my first impulse is also always to start, like, if I sit on the couch and then I look at something and then I'm like, what happens if I move this vase here?
Yes.
And I always start moving things physically.
Yes.
As like a first response to the sense of boredom. And then from that, it goes into something else. But I just, what do you think is underneath this need to physically move things when you are bored?
I know this to be true from like a spiritual perspective, and some people might be rolling their eyes right now, but I really believe that stuckness in our being, you know, like feeling stuck and gaga, is something that we also feel because of our physical spaces being maybe stagnant for some time, and that moving things around creates a fresh perspective. And if you think of feng shui, if you believe in the philosophy of feng shui, it is important to move things that have been stagnant for a few months. And they also have this, there's regular practices, I can't remember them all now, at some point I was very hectically into that, but certain things are not supposed to be stagnant in your home for too long because they believe the energy needs to shift. So I was talking to someone that's moving into a new house. She called me an integrated nester this morning, which I want to print on my CV because I do think I'm an integrated nester. I've moved so often in my life and created homes that I know what is required of settling down, and she wanted to start buying things immediately. And it's also a form of kind of being busy and productive all the time, is that she finally has a home space, but now the home space needs to be perfect. I actually have two friends that's going through this right now. And she wants to buy the couch now. Both of them want to buy couches now.
I'm going to do that.
So maybe I can share what I shared with them with you as well, Jana. It's like, I read once that, and I can't remember the name of this body memory, but there's a kind of body memory that we have in terms of when you can switch a light on in your house in the dark and know exactly which switch to go for first. That memory has a kind of memory, and it's not a conscious memory, it's a subconscious memory. So our bodies take about 3 to 6 months to learn that memory in new spaces. That's why moving is so traumatic, because we have adapted like on a mental conscious level to the move already and caught up, but our body is still learning how to navigate the space with our eyes closed. So there's a phantom map in our brains of our physical spaces, and that's why it takes so much time to land in a space and really feel ready in a space. And I now, only after a year, feel rested and landed in the space now, and only now the moving of the lounge starts making sense to me. I feel like we're really settling. That's why people often say also, you shouldn't buy the couch immediately in moving in, because only after you've gone through all the seasons of the year you understand the rhythm of the space, and that's when those decisions make sense. So I know it's 100%. Difficult, but
it's a temptation.
Yeah,
because we also recently moved and realized that we don't have a lot of, like, we needed a lot of, or we thought we needed a lot of things.
Yes,
and we are also in this process of like, this month we save and we buy a table, and then now I'm realizing how expensive dining chairs or whatever, but something about waiting, even though it's only been like 5 months or so, but like waiting and realizing how your needs change and how you occupy the space, and as you said, like where the light comes in and how that would affect whatever. I also like resonate with that, and I think there's something about the slowness of crafting a home that relates to our topic about work, because it's so tempting to do things quickly and to get it done, and it's almost like bracketed out of your mind to like, so that it doesn't occupy you.
It's because we're taught to achieve something. Yeah. So now nesting and landing is also something you achieve by doing.
You have to do it and it's hard work that you have to achieve quickly. So sitting with that sense of uncomfortability with an unfinished space is something that has also kind of challenged the way I think about being bored, and even noticing those things and not always going into the temptation of trying to fix it, but just looking out to something different in the space.
But just to wrap a bow around that segment of the conversation, I think that internal stuckness can sometimes be reflected in our spaces, and then we start moving things around.
Yeah.
That's like, I am so over the winter right now, and I think this is what's, you know, the spring fever is kind of about in terms of spring cleaning and moving things around, because, you know, it's like we were stuck in a space for so long, there needs to be freshness, you know, before winter we're so ready to hibernate and just like do nothing, and then just in terms of come to Jesus, it's over an hour now. I have more to say. Are we going to continue talking, or should we wrap it up?
I'm also wondering that now. Uh-huh. what more? Let's pause.
Other things. Okay, so we decided to go a little bit more. the other day, Jana reflected something really interesting to me. I was saying how fatigued I was by the physical classes that I did during summer last year and having to take a break during winter, realizing how physically fatigued I was. And then she said to me, yeah, even thinking about your training at university, when we had to put up exhibitions, we had to, in 24 hours, paint an entire room, clean an entire space, install an exhibition, label it, curate it, everything, and then go and take it down after it was marked for maybe 15 minutes by our lecturers, maybe half an hour if they took that much time. And just the standard of physical intensity of that, and now kind of taking that into my practice as an art facilitator teacher, and then, you know, doing the marketing, doing the content design, setting up the space, teaching the workshop, setting it all down in, like, you know, 2 weeks' time, and just the intensity of that. And then also having to, it was a really good moment. I'm really grateful you said that to me, because then I had to go and think about it a bit. I was like, oh, my standard of what it is that I can do physically is, I think, so much higher than other people think of, you know, what they can do. I don't know, I'm assuming, but I see this as a trend in creatives of, you know, like, overcompensating because we don't have a linearity in the way that the creativity functions. You know, like I said, a lot of it is sitting and staring at nothing until you have inspiration. And then maybe, I mean, I paint really fast when I paint, so it comes out in such a, you know,
like
burst, and then there's nothing for some time. And that's when I started becoming really interested in this, like, cyclical nature of creativity. And I find this topic that you brought up fascinating, because, like I said earlier, I did a webinar yesterday, which, by the way, I'm going to plug myself here now, if that's okay. It's hosted on my website now, and you can purchase the recording if you want to go listen to it. Just reach out to me on social media or email, whatever, and we can arrange that. But it was about the difference between a creative block and a creative winter, where the creative winter is a natural pause within the creative cycle that is necessary for this recharging of the subconscious archive and the resting and the integration of a project that had happened, where a creative block is being stuck because of a wound that you have, or a pattern or a way of thinking that is not conducive to a sustainable creative practice.
Okay, yeah.
So that's kind of like what it was about. And I think that creatives struggle a lot with this kind of productivity thing, because it's not so clear cut what makes us productive.
Yeah.
And when I started working for myself in my creative practice, I deliberately for a year took Mondays off, because I realized that every Monday I was in a panic because everyone around me went to work and got instruction what they had to do for the week there. And I had this gap of not having anyone giving me instructions, which would put me in a complete manic panic and anxiety. And I would just overwork to overcompensate for this, you know, who the hell is going to tell me what to do? There's no one to tell me what to do. So then I would take Mondays off to listen to my intuition. That was literally my practice, is I did this extensive Monday morning work practice, but it was a worth ethic practice.
Yeah.
I'm going to find that.
We need to play that song at the end.
I'm going to find that now. But yeah, so that's just like my kind of way of thinking also of, as creatives, how we think about being productive. I had this insight I got from a palm tree once. Palm trees speak to me, that's why I paint them. But it told me, like, you need to stop thinking that one creative action equals an output. I found it equals like one equals one, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where you can work your entire life as a creative, and then within 1 year you make all your success, you know.
Yeah.
You have to go through the steps. I also read this book that said that you need to design your website, you need to design your business card, your elevator pitch, all your things. You have to get your supporting materials ready, not because it's going to bring you business immediately, but one day you might need it, you know.
Yeah. So not that linear connection between what you do now and what it will lead to. And I think, like, it's just like I mean, I think Nicoline would say that everyone is a creative and yes. that there's...
So don't say something else.
No, I'm not. We want to say okay. something else. So I want to say that this applies to everyone.
Yes, 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 yes. I want to... Whether you're creating your life you know, or you're creating...
Whatever you do, don't think that you are excluded from what Nicoline is saying.
No.
But I do also think there are multiple career roles where... you know, work doesn't end at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And, you know, or a lot of people purposefully or unpurposefully just continue that on and off switch between when you work and when you don't work. And I'm also experiencing that now where I'm like crafting my day, but technically I could work the whole time
yeah.
if I wanted to,
yeah.
which I don't. But something about that idea of rest and not overcompensating
yeah.
in terms of what you think you should be doing to work, and that
yeah.
there's anything like working enough or working
yeah. And also there's this I think Sarah Blondin also said there's like sometimes we need to step out of doing and into being, and we have forgotten that we're human beings and not human doings, and that it is enough just to be, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't even know if we know how to be it. We almost have to practice, which is a doing, to be.
Yeah.
But you know, that even this idea of enough, you know, in terms of work, like, we are enough even outside of working. You know, I think our survival, this is something I wanted to say earlier, I'm just going to mention it as well. I'm reading the Clan of the Cave Bear books. I love fiction. The books are about the kind of the split between the first humans and the kind of Neanderthal people that lived with them or coincided with
yeah.
them at the same time. And so the books are a lot about the kind of ways of living in that time. So there's a lot of like how the tribe functions, how they store, like the writer really goes into detail about like harvesting medicines and storing medicines, and that kind of constant working was so in harmony with nature. Like, it really makes sense when you read the book how we were part of the ecosystem as humans. In the ways of how when we remove wolves now from the ecosystem, it collapses. Humans have had a similar way of like being creatures on the earth, adding to those kind of cycles and rhythms. And then, but that was for survival. And then what we did is we put our survival into money, which was this entity that or thing that we now get through other kinds of working. And I think that separation really fucked a bit with us, you know, of like how our worth is now tied to money,
yeah.
where in the past our worth was tied to how we contributed to the survival of the collective, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that I also thought of now as he was speaking is that worth, you know, the worth connection of work, but also the opposite of work that we kind of think of as leisure,
yeah.
like leisure practices
also,
so,
being something that we do
yeah so we spoke a lot now about like doing nothing and doing boredom, but that's not even the same as just as leisure activities. That's more like what we do when we are on holiday,
yeah.
or these like things that we do to carve out fun times, you know, when do you go to the ocean in your everyday life, and
no,
when
you also
you
have
drink...
to feel like kind of accomplished by doing that.
Yeah.
Like a holiday will only be a holiday if you've accomplished some things, you
yeah
know?
Exactly. But there is something of also I think the profoundness that we find when we practice leisure activities,
yeah,
and also like some of the skills, I guess, not
yeah.
skills in and out like work advance yourself set of
yeah.
way, but just ways of being in life that we learn more and uncover
yeah.
during leisure periods.
Yeah.
This is something I wanted to say.
No, very interesting.
Should we listen to this song
and end it off?
We're
going to end it off. So thank you very much. And I can fade it out if
don't
you
don't
want
go back
to
work. No, you can.
Think about your worth ethic.
Yeah, this is a good motivation for that. And I'm also curious because I've never heard the song.
Oh, I've played it off my phone now, which has 1%.
You could have possibly inserted it or something.
I don't know.
Let's see.
If it'll work.
Live reaction.
My phone died.
Wait, let me find it. I'll find it. On what are you listening to?
Apple Music.
Okay. Let's just hold on.
I think we'll have copywriting issues if we just try to insert it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I might have copywriting issues anyway, but we're not famous yet, so
yeah.
we have to deal with the lawsuits.
What's
one day.
The name? Worth
Ethic. That one, yeah.
Let's see. This is the point where people will now fall asleep.
A long the music intro.
Will ease you into it.
I'm unapologetic with my priorities. I ask for help despite my mental stories of being told no. I create my daily ritual. I commit to my non-negotiables. I've known, I've experienced benefits from burning out. The wins from Team No Sleep are bossy. But I'm entering a new level of my worth ethic. An evolved way to do business, knowing the business of my life deserves me to flow. The relationship between my work ethic and my well-being are a healthy one. I entertain reimagining my well-being, fueling my grind. I allow myself to be still and listen to divine guidance to give myself permission to be loyal to my intuition. I won't rush anything. I choose not to stress out. R.I.P. anxiety. I create what I want my Monday to feel like. I get to choose those thoughts. My weekend is not a retreat from my weekdays. My life, my feelings are not determined by a day of the week. My life has no day. It has moments. I receive the truth of this. I work on believing this more. I release the temptation to practice the habit of sacrificing my nutrition for the grind. I'm a hydrated woman. Knowing my well-being is the fuel to my gorgeous work ethic. Because of my work, I create agency for my business practices improving. I will organize my admin tasks for my business. I no longer procrastinate because I release the belief that I procrastinate. I treat my time as my moneymaker. I am a source of power in my business. I am not a slave to my business. I know and I learn my numbers for my business, or I find someone who can. My business systems are of excellence. I attract assistance to the needs of my business. I know who I serve.
You can find the rest of the song on Apple Music or wherever you find your music.
And remember to restfully stay stimulated.
Until next time.
ERIT is a team effort. It is produced by Nicolien Burger and Jana Vosloo. Marga Leupscher contributes visually by creating beautiful artworks and social media content.
Tabu Krokan produced the intro and outro music. And reach out to us if you have an idea of how ERIT can expand.
And remember,
stay stimulated.